From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi plans to meet with Democrats tomorrow to talk about an impeachment trial. Republicans are trying to clarify the president's uncorroborated claim that Iranian General Qasem Soleimani was killed because he was about to attack four American embassies. Today, President Trump tweeted out, "It doesn't matter how imminent, Soleimani had a bad history." Iranians angry about the assassination are now furious at their own leaders for mistakenly downing that Ukrainian airliner, killing 176 people. Let's bring in Senator Chris Murphy, a Democrat from Connecticut, on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Senator, where in your view are we now on Iran?
I think we are right now in a fairly precarious position. We can talk about the lack of intelligence about an imminent threat that led up to the attack on Soleimani. But probably the most serious consequence of that is that the Iraqis now want U.S. forces out of that country. We have about 5,000 troops there that are continuing to take the fight to ISIS, obviously one of the most brutal terrorist organizations in the world that is in the process of regrouping today. And if the United States is kicked out of Iraq, then it has real upside for ISIS. They will be able to get stronger, downside for U.S. national security interests. So that's maybe what I worry most about today. But as the intel and the analysis of it shifts, I also really worry about this administration's credibility. I mean, it is really exceptional to mislead the American public about why you struck out against another country. And I think they've got to sort of be very clear about this soon, whether there really was an imminent attack or whether they just wanted to kill Qasem Soleimani and did it when they had the opportunity. Because the worst thing you can do when it comes to the national security power of the president is to lie to the American people about why you're putting our troops at risk overseas.
Well, as you well know, Defense Secretary Mark Esper tried to clarify the president's remarks that he believed the general was planning attacks on four U.S. embassies. Here he is on CBS, being pressed for details by Face the Nation host Margaret Brennan.
Probably and could have been. That is, that sounds more like an assessment than a specific, tangible threat with a decisive piece of intelligence.
Well, the president didn't say there was a tangible, he didn't cite a specific piece of evidence. What he said is he believed.
Are you saying there wasn't one?
I didn't see one with regard to four embassies.
I didn't see one with regard to four embassies. Now, you were briefed by Esper last Wednesday, just to back that up. Did he mention imminent attacks on embassies then?
No. Yeah. We were in a 75-minute briefing. If they had evidence of planned attacks against embassies, they would have mentioned it because they were getting pressed pretty hard by senators on their lack of information regarding an imminent threat. And it's not just that Trump said that there was a threat against four embassies. Secretary of State Pompeo said that at the end of last week as well. And so I think this is, I mean, I've never seen this. I've never seen
I'm so sorry to interrupt, but we have seen this in that in the war in Iraq, we saw claims of weapons of mass destruction that didn't exist.
Well, I guess what I was going to say is that I've never seen a Secretary of Defense so clearly conflicting the rationale for a military strike being given by the Secretary of State, which just speaks to the dysfunction in this administration. Mm-hmm. Of course, we have seen prior administrations misconstrue intelligence in a lead up to war, which is why we all have to be very clear that only Congress has the power to declare war, not the president. And I just also worry that we're not done. I just think that the Iranians or Iranian proxies in Iraq may take out further future strikes. And that's why we need to make it clear right now that it's only the United States Congress that can make the decision moving forward to take additional strikes against Iran or their proxies.
We want to quickly get your thoughts on the possible impeachment trial, which may start end of this week, next week, or not at all. President Trump has been tweeting out now there should be no trial. And on ABC yesterday, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi criticized the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell for signing onto a resolution dismissing this case if Pelosi doesn't send over the two articles, which she has not sent over yet.
Dismissing is a cover-up. If they want to go that route again, the senators who are thinking now about voting for witnesses or not, they will have to be accountable for not having a fair trial.
Do you think the Democrats have the votes and the muscle to get witnesses like John Bolton?
I don't know. I mean, I think we're going to have to wait until those votes are before the United States Senate. I have a hard time figuring out how Republican senators could, you know, vote to willingly box their ears and close their eyes when John Bolton clearly says he has a story to tell. Ultimately, they may vote to acquit the president, but I think it'll be really hard to tell their constituents that they didn't want information that was being offered to the United States Senate. So ultimately, I think it's going to take Democrats bringing votes up on the Senate floor to get witnesses and documents. And I think there's a good chance we'll have more than four Republican votes, but I really don't know.
Senator Chris Murphy, the Democrat from Connecticut, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Millions of Puerto Ricans are waiting to see if President Trump will authorize much-needed aid after several earthquakes devastated parts of the island, the latest a 5.9 magnitude quake on Saturday, the strongest since last week's 6.4 earthquake. Thousands of people are still in shelters, and many others are sleeping outside. Joining us now for more is Michael Fernandez, executive director of CARES, a nonprofit based in Puerto Rico. He's in Cataño near San Juan. And Michael, you're worried about the impact on school children. Tell us more.
I think that we may very well be facing an educational crisis in terms of how do we manage classes being reinitiated, not only in the towns that were severely impacted by the earthquake, but for the rest of the system. As we are conducting evaluations of infrastructure, we will be learning whether or not the infrastructure suffered damage, but also if that infrastructure would be able to withstand an earthquake. And this is something that's very present in the mind of every Puerto Rican, since we have all seen the images of the school that collapsed during the earthquake of January 7th. And so the logistics of how do we offer a safe shelter for our students to learn in is something that we need to start thinking about and proactively planning to consider, you know, how we can do it in the best way.
Yeah, most of the children had been on holiday. It was during the holiday season when these earthquakes hit, and now they can't go back to school. Your nonprofit is opening community centers to host workshops to help the kids manage everything going on and process what they're seeing.
Yes, ma'am. So we are opening on extended hours to receive students who are out of school and try to help them to get back to some sort of a daily routine. We're basing this on the experience of Hurricane Maria, where our schools were out of session for several months. And we know the impact that that has on the emotional stability of our students and our families.
There was a deep impact to school infrastructure after Hurricane Maria, but there were also the closing of nearly 200 schools even before that because of this deep and prolonged debt crisis. Can you talk a little bit more about, in the light of all of that, why this is so significant?
Yes, if you look at the past 5 years, our economy has failed. Then we had Hurricanes Irma and Maria. We had a political crisis where we were able to oust the governor over the summer, and now this. I think it's been a lot of profound changes to our daily lives and our projections for the future. So it weighs heavily on everybody, emotionally and physically. It doesn't mean that our spirit is down. It's just that we've been through a lot in the past 5 years.
Seismologists say that these quakes could continue for a couple of weeks, so there's a lot of uncertainty here. Can you just describe to me the sentiment and how people are feeling and reacting there right now?
I think that there's two main emotions that have come together. And one is one of anxiety, because it's very hard to predict whether or not there will be another earthquake and whether or not our infrastructure will withstand. But it is also that deep sense of resiliency that we all have that helped us overcome the challenges of Hurricane Maria, the economic and political challenges that the country has faced, and now again with this earthquake. Our spirit of perseverance is very present, and that would be independent of any declaration of the president that we know has previously taken a discriminatory stance towards the island. And so obviously we would love for that declaration to take place, but we are willing and able to do what needs to get done in spite of any form of government, whether it's our local government or the federal government.
At the same time, being able to have that funding, I'm sure, would be a great help in all of this. What are you hearing about damage assessment so far?
Well, that everything is backed up, because any assessment that had been made previous to Saturday needs to be done again because of that earthquake on Saturday. And I'm surprised with some of our own infrastructure where we thought we were a lot better off than where we are, which means that will alter our contingency plans in terms of how to manage the situation. And again, I think that one of the main areas besides the crisis that is going on in the South is how do we restart our public school system? And I know the Department of Education is active in working on those plans, but in terms of logistics, it's just a complicated scenario with a lot of uncertainty.
Michael Fernandez is executive director of CARES, a nonprofit based in Puerto Rico. Michael, thank you so much for your time.
I want to say thank you to you, but also to all of the Americans on the mainland who have always reached out to us and, you know, just shared their solidarity with us. That means a lot. So we appreciate it very much.
So how are those New Year's resolutions going? If one of them was to climb on board the very crowded Less Sugar in 2020 train, you were probably horrified to find out how insidiously sugar and its evil twin fructose have been added to our food. There's a teaspoon of sugar in every tablespoon of ketchup. Our next guest says our food has been adulterated, poisoned, and he's not kidding. He says sugar plays a central role in health problems, including an epidemic of obesity in infants as young as 6 months, that it's as dangerous as smoking or abusive alcohol. Oh, and if you're doing the New York Times 7-day sugar challenge, they say even grapes and bananas have too much sugar. Dr. Robert Lustig is professor of pediatric endocrinology at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Rob, people know sugar isn't a health food. Why is it so dangerous?
Well, so people think that sugar is just empty calories. And they think, well, you get some discretionary calories during the day, so why can't they be sugar? Mm. Well, if sugar were just calories, then they'd be right, except they're wrong, because different calories in foods are burned and absorbed, digested, metabolized in different ways and do different things and contribute to different diseases.
So I just want to underscore what you've said, because the rule has always been calories in, calories out. You just got to burn it off somewhere in the middle. And you are saying, again, that is not true. What do sugar calories do?
Right. So why are sugar calories so different? Well, they're different for three reasons. The first is when sugar is absorbed, it goes to the liver, and the liver gets overwhelmed because it has a limited capacity to metabolize it, just like it has a limited capacity to metabolize alcohol, just like it has a limited capacity to metabolize many of the toxins that we take in, you know, because your liver is the detoxification center of your body. It has a limited capacity for being able to deal with sugar. When you overwhelm it, the liver has no choice but to take the excess and turn it into liver fat. And that liver fat is the driver of virtually every chronic disease that we are now currently suffering from that's gone up in time. So type 2 diabetes, lipid problems, hypertension, cardiovascular disease, cancer, dementia, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, polycystic ovarian disease, all being driven by liver fat. And the liver fat is because of the sugar. And so you can basically have alcoholic fatty liver disease if you're over 21, or you can have non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, and it doesn't make a difference because they are identical. And so we have done several liver transplants in soda drinkers, you know, teenage soda drinkers.
Transplants. And talk about the insidiousness of sodas. And I gotta, you know, this is, I'm one of those people, I pride myself, I don't drink coffee, but I picked up a little bit of a soda habit, and it's just appalling to think of how.
Well, it's not a habit.
It's an addiction.
It's not a habit. It's an addiction. Yeah. And, you know, anybody who says, oh, you know, I have this horrible sweet tooth, that's sugar addiction.
Yeah.
So sugar is addictive in the same way as alcohol, in the same way as nicotine, cocaine, amphetamine, heroin. Shopping, gambling, social media, internet pornography, all of these stimulate the same area of the brain called the reward center, the nucleus accumbens. Yeah. Anything that causes the release of dopamine is in the extreme addictive.
Well, and you call this the Coca-Cola conspiracy because you say it's not by accident. It's not just that there's a ton of caffeine added to sodas that makes you then pee, pardon my inelegance. They also add salt. So the combination makes you thirstier, so you drink more.
Exactly. So they know what they're doing. Do you have to put salt in Coke? There used to be a cola called Royal Crown Cola. It didn't have any salt in it. I mean, Coca-Cola knocked them out of the park. But the fact is, you don't have to put salt in soda. So this is by design.
Well, and then fructose was sold to us as more natural sugar. This is in corn and beets and such. But as you point out, one of the things they do in fructose, which is added to just about everything, is strip the fiber out of it so that it has a longer shelf life. So it has absolutely none of that benefit. And why is fructose as bad as sugar?
So first of all, sugar is two molecules bound together, glucose and fructose. Now, glucose is not all that bad. It's not great, but it's not that bad. However, fructose, because it is metabolized into that liver fat in the liver, that's where the problem comes in. In addition, fructose starts the aging reaction. It causes what we call caramelization. It's the reason for wrinkles. It's the reason for cataracts. This aging reaction, this browning reaction. And fructose does it seven times faster than glucose. And now we have learned through work done at Joslin Diabetes Center that fructose specifically inhibits a mitochondrial enzyme that causes those mitochondria to burn less well, which probably is one of the reasons for the persistent weight gain and also chronic disease. And glucose doesn't do that. So there are some very specific differences between these two molecules. However, when you consume any form of sugar, whether it's sucrose, which is table sugar, cane sugar, beet sugar, the stuff you put in your coffee, or high fructose corn syrup, or honey, or maple syrup, or agave, doesn't matter, you are getting one of each molecule. And so sugar is a problem because of the fructose molecule.
Look, we have just a couple minutes left. I urge people to watch your lecture. But you draw a direct line from the state we're in today to the health industry and the government. In 1982, we were told, cut out fats. And so everybody went to carbs. And of course, carbs are filled with all these sugars that you're talking about. And by the way, obesity went up when we cut out fats and went to carbs. You go back to Nixon in the early 1970s, who there was a political crisis. Food was too expensive. He directed his agriculture department to cheapen it, which they did by adding a lot of these, you know, corn syrup products. You call fructose, you call fructose a poison. And one would ask, well, why wouldn't our own FDA regulate a poison? Well, one of our biggest exports is our food. Of course, the food industry pushes back on your claims and the claims of others, but people know what they can see with their own eyes. They don't feel well. They see their children are overweight. A lot of people now are doing things like the New York Times 7-day sugar challenge, trying to cut back. The first day, you know, no sugar at breakfast. How would you help people do this, given that it is so addictive and it is so everywhere?
Right. So I will be very honest with you. We will not solve this problem until the food industry solves it for us. And they have no interest in doing so because this is their gravy train. This is their juggernaut. This is how they went from 1% gross profit margin to 5% gross profit margin in the span of 3 decades. This is their livelihood. And they are not going to do anything they don't have to do. And unfortunately, the government's in bed with them because they're making $56 billion a year off export tariffs off our food. So the only way we are going to fix this problem is when there are more votes than dollars. And right now, we're just beginning to, you know, get some traction in the general public for this issue of food. Mm-hmm. Having said that, people need to understand what the problem is. They have to understand the difference between processed food and real food. And the difference is processed food is high sugar, low fiber. High sugar for palatability, low fiber for shelf life. Real food is low sugar, high fiber. Real food works. Processed food doesn't. Processed food kills because of these issues. And we could, repeat, could fix this tomorrow if we wanted to. The problem is because sugar is addictive, people don't want to.
One of the saddest things in your lecture is you talk about children who have these serious health issues now that are traced to the juices that they're given. And these are low-income children, and the juices come to them through the government WIC program.
Exactly right.
It's got to be tough for you to see those children.
Impossible. It breaks your heart. You know, the fact of the matter is these kids are victims, and we know who the perpetrators are. And the fact is, the parents don't understand. And so it promulgates itself. The fact is what mothers eat during pregnancy ultimately impact on the number of fat cells children are born with. And those fat cells want to get filled. So these kids didn't have a chance even before they were born, never mind afterwards. I mean, how do you blame a six-month-old for obesity? The fact of the matter is we have a problem and we have to address it, and no one is.
Provocative. We're going to link people to your lecture, to the 7-Day Sugar Challenge, if people want to try it, and to other writing at hereandnow.org. Dr. Robert Lustig, professor of pediatric endocrinology at the University of California, San Francisco. Rob, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And by the way, Dr. Lustig is cataloging all the different names that added sugar goes by, to hide it. He says it's listed up to 300. He wants you to add to it. It's the Sugar Project.
Texas is now the first state to refuse new refugees as part of the government's refugee resettlement program. The state has traditionally been one of the most welcoming states for refugees. Texas Governor Greg Abbott's action comes under President Trump's executive order, making it mandatory for states and local authorities to consent to resettling refugees within their borders. For more on this, we're joined by Julian Aguilar, reporter for the Texas Tribune. And Julian, Texas is the first to refuse refugees, as I said. More than 40 governors, including many Republicans, have already chosen to stay in, however. How exactly does the refugee resettlement program work?
What the refugee resettlement does is it finds an initial state that is willing to accept refugee folks. And what it does is it uses some of these monies for the program to partner with these state programs to settle refugees there. So in essence, Governor Abbott said that the refugee agencies that are active in Texas will not be able to directly relocate these folks. But that's not to say that somebody can't move to another state in the country that's accepted into the program and then eventually move to Texas. He was the first one to do it. He waited a good amount to pull the trigger on his decision, but I don't think his decision surprised a lot of folks given his history with resettlement programs.
Yeah. Previous to this, though, Texas had been a leader in resettlement, accepting a little over 8,000 refugees back in 2009. And State Representative Vicki Goodwin, a Democrat from Austin, says she believes this is not just a moral but an economic issue. How much do refugees contribute to the economy and social fabric of Texas?
They spend billions of dollars, and they also are very, very good at startup businesses and employing folks. Now, given the size of the state's economy, this decision is not going to put Texas into the red by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, the concern is just the signal that it sends. It's not going to destroy the state's economy. Well, compared to the number of folks that are already here, compared to the number of immigrants that are trying to seek asylum in Texas or elsewhere, the number that Texas might have received had they opted in would also be relatively small, specifically because the president capped the number of refugees that the administration was even going to allow at 18,000 for this year, which is the lowest amount that it's been in several years.
You know, I want to go back to something you said earlier about Governor Abbott, that this was expected, that he would make this decision, that he would leave this program. What are some of the reasons why he says this is good for Texas?
He says that, they've got to concentrate on the folks that are here. He mentioned in his letter that Texas had been left to shoulder most of the burden for the broken immigration system, referencing the number of folks that were apprehended at the southern border. But that's different than the resettlement program. The resettlement program, they apply overseas, they're thoroughly vetted, and they come in through different means. But nonetheless, the governor still referenced the fact that Texas had seen a large surplus over the last few years. And he's accurate. You know, the Rio Grande Valley down in the southern part of Texas has been the busiest for unauthorized crossings for several years now.
The Trump administration's initial executive order has already been challenged in the courts. What's next?
You are correct. There was litigation filed, and arguments in that case were heard less than a week ago. This was on Wednesday of last week. So it could be a moot point, but you know, who knows how many folks are going to want to be resettled in Texas, given the fact that the governor is on record opting out of the program, regardless of what the federal judge rules and what should be the coming weeks.
That's Julian Aguilar, reporter for the Texas Tribune. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Thanks to a recent court ruling, the Dutch government is ratcheting up its commitments to address climate change. An environmental group successfully sued, forcing the government by the end of the year to cut the nation's greenhouse gas emissions by 25% from 1990 levels. Dennis Van Berkel is legal counsel for the Urgenda Foundation, which filed the lawsuit, and he joins me on Skype from the Netherlands. And Dennis, your argument was that the Dutch government's targeting for reducing greenhouse gas emissions was so inadequate they jeopardized human rights. How did you make that case to the court?
I mean, it was a very extraordinary case. You don't normally go to a court and say, well, this is the policy that I want. So what we explained to the court was, first and foremost, the grave dangers of climate change and how unique they are in size, and the fact that for over 25 years, the Dutch government, together with all the other governments in the world, recognized this danger but didn't do anything. So we argued that the dangers of climate change are so big that they threaten to violate our human rights and are, in fact, already threatening human rights around the world. And that such the violation of these human rights created an obligation on the state to prevent these harms from coming into being. And the only way to do that is to lower emissions.
Of course, you went to the court with that intent, but were you surprised by your victory?
Well, I guess yes and no. I mean, we didn't know that we would win, but we knew that we had a very strong argument. And the Dutch state itself had recognized time and time and time again, as any other country in the world, that climate change is a huge threat and that current efforts were not enough in order to prevent these threats. So we thought we had a very good legal basis to ask the court to order the state to reduce its emissions.
As we mentioned, your victory in court means the Dutch government has to now cut the nation's greenhouse gas emissions by 25% from 1990 levels by the end of 2020. In practical terms, what does that mean for the Netherlands?
Well, the government has taken a number of measures. It has increased subsidies for people to install, for instance, certain insulations or solar panels on their houses and a bunch of other things, including closure of coal-fired power plants. Unfortunately, they haven't done enough, so they'll have to do more. There's still a very significant gap, so they'll have to take additional measures in the very short term. It would have been better if they had taken more time for that. But now it's, you know, one of the things that they'll probably have to do to in order to reach the target is to close an additional couple of coal-fired power plants.
Yes. Tell us more a little bit about that. I mean, are power plants on a larger scale going to have to shut down there?
Well, coal is the most polluting energy source in the world. And unfortunately, in the Netherlands, just a couple of new coal-fired power plants were opened in 2015 and 2016. There is other less polluting generating capacity still available in this area of Europe and also inside of the Netherlands. But because coal is cheaper at the moment and coal is not paying for its pollution, those coal-fired power plants are still running. But this judgment basically says, well, you know, it's not just about the costs. These emissions are causing harm. One of the most likely measures that the government will have to take is to close these plants down and to speed up their investment in alternative sources. And in the meantime, they're still, you know, it doesn't mean that the lights have to go out here.
Right.
But it does mean that they have to treat the transition to renewable energy with much more urgency than they have done so far.
I'm thinking about the Netherlands' place in the world. It's just one country, so even a big victory there might not do much to reverse the global trend toward climate catastrophe, is really what we're talking about. Do you think this ruling could have happened in any other country, say the United States?
I'm convinced that it can. The legal principles that we use in this case are not unique, and the facts are not unique to the Netherlands at all. And I think it's very telling, for instance, that on the day of the judgment, the UN High Commissioner on Human Rights came out with a statement saying that, you know, this judgment implies that also all other countries around the world, under fundamental international human rights law, have legal obligations to reduce their emissions. Right. So this is not a unique thing to the Netherlands. I mean, the Dutch government also said, we're just a small country. It doesn't really matter what we do. And that's what we see all countries say, right? For instance, now in Australia, you see the Australian prime minister say, well, you know, Australia is just tiny, so we're not going to do anything about climate change, regardless of the fact that the whole country is on fire because of the impacts of climate change. This ruling shows that argument just doesn't fly. You have a legal obligation to do your part. And that's the sort of the main message of this judgment.
There are other climate lawsuits around the world. How do you have a big impact? Is there any possibility of legal action in international courts, which are, after all, based right there in The Hague?
Well, international law and also the courts on the international level move slowly. And to get a case, I mean, there are efforts to get a case before the International Court of Justice. Countries themselves will basically have to agree before a case gets put before that court. So, but as a citizen, you can't directly go to that court. But as a citizen, you can go to your own court in your own country. And those courts have an obligation to listen to your case and have an obligation to, in the event that they also come to the conclusion that your rights are being violated, to then come with some sort of remedy, which, you know, in the context of climate change, the only real viable remedy is that emissions need to be lowered, because that's the only way we can prevent these catastrophic impacts.
Why target the government with these legal challenges and not fossil fuel companies?
Well, because governments have very particular responsibilities towards their citizens. That's the first reason. Under, you know, almost every constitution, governments have obligations with regards to their citizens. And those obligations are the obligations and the rights that we used in this case. And governments also, as well, have recognized, you know, since 1992, when the Framework Convention on Climate Change was closed, all governments in the world recognize that they have a responsibility. They recognize that they are the prime entities responsible for dealing with this problem. And they repeated that when closing the Kyoto Protocol. Again, in 2015, all countries in the world repeated, yes, this is a tremendous problem. We are responsible and we need to solve this. That's the first part. And the second part also is, governments have the type of systemic powers that you need to solve this problem. Now, we'll really need to completely reinvent the energy system. Large investments will need to be made, because often renewable energy is cheaper than the fossil fuel alternative. But you have to make upfront investments. And states are uniquely equipped and sort of the only real entity in the world that is able to take these types of steps.
I want to ask you one last question about the most recent UN negotiations on climate change in Madrid. At the end of the year, there was little progress to show for it. What do you make of the sluggish pace of international action on climate change? I mean, this is 4 years after the Paris Agreement, which was hailed as really the new era for global action to deal with the climate crisis.
I think it's extremely disconcerting. Basically, nothing was achieved in Madrid, and that was an achievement in itself, because there was a big threat that there would be a big step back. I mean, so that's how dire the situation right now is. And it only increases the chance that more of these cases will pop up around the world. I mean, it's my honest hope that we don't need to go to court all around the world, people all around the world, to demand that their rights are being respected. I mean, it's the role of the government to act in the interest of the people. And there's no doubt about it that that interest is to deal with this problem as they have recognized for over decades now. This year in 2020 is the year that countries agreed that they would increase their ambition that they laid down in Paris, because Paris didn't set a target. It just set in a mechanism of continuously increasing the ambition. So that's what we desperately need. And if countries are not going to go through with those increases of ambition and taking additional action, it's just inevitable that people will go to the courts and demand that their rights are being respected.
That's Dennis van Berkel, legal counsel for the Urgenda Foundation, a Dutch environmental group that successfully sued the government there to force action on climate change. Dennis, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tanya.
Immigration will likely be a big issue this election season. Would that the electorate was informed about it. New research dives into misconceptions that people have about immigrants across Europe and the U.S. For example, they overestimate how many immigrants there are and the number that are unemployed or on public assistance. We heard elsewhere on this program how much immigrants contribute to the Texas economy. The bulk of data shows immigrants in the U.S. don't push down wages, commit fewer crimes than native-born Americans, revitalize dying small towns. Why don't we know that? Derek Thompson has been looking at the new research. He's senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from Washington every Monday. Hi, Derek.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Good to speak with you. And this research comes from two Harvard professors, Alberto Alessina and Stephanie Stancheva. What did they look at?
So these researchers surveyed native-born people in the U.S. and across Europe, in Germany, France, Italy, Sweden. And they asked people, what do you think about immigrants? And how does new information update your views? And this is a really important question for a lot of reasons, some of which you just said. In the U.S., immigration is a very salient issue. As we know, international migration has been rising in the last few years. There are more immigrants as a share of the population in many European countries. And in the U.S., it's near an all-time high. And so it's important to know what people think about the immigration population. Right. And these surveys went right to that question.
Well, for instance, in the U.S., people tend to overestimate the number of legal immigrants that are here. What do the numbers say?
Right. So three big findings from this paper. First, people in both the U.S. and Europe consistently overestimate the share of immigrants, as you said. For example, in the U.S., the actual number of legal immigrants is about 10% of the population. Respondents estimated that it was closer to 40% of the population. So they were wrong by a factor of four. Number two, respondents especially overestimate the share of Muslim immigrants. When you ask people about the immigrant population, they tend to overestimate the share that are Muslims. And number three, respondents believe that immigrants are less educated, more likely to be employed, and more reliant on the welfare state than they actually are. So across the board, you see that people overestimate the number, think more of them are Muslim, and think that overall they're more of a drag on the economy.
Why is this?
It's a really, really good question. And a part of it, I think, is politics, and a part of it is basic human psychology. I do think that we see across a lot of psychological studies involving immigrants and stuff that has nothing to do with politics, a sort of preference for the familiar. People have a preference for the familiar in artistic taste, in music, and movies. We also, unfortunately, have a preference for the familiar in ethnicity. We are more likely to feel generous toward people that are our own ethnic group and more likely to be accepting of welfare policies that help people from our own ethnic group. So that is the sort of human psychology aspect of it. On the political side, though, I think it's the fact that immigration is often politicized. When there's a problem in the U.S., when wages are stagnating, or when industries are going away, politicians aren't likely to blame faceless macroeconomic forces. They're more likely to blame human beings. And so they blame immigrants often when they can't blame more vague ideas.
Well, and also I would imagine that if you can speak anecdotally of a problem in your specific town, let's say a gang, then that's your world. And you feel that that represents the world of immigrants. But I'm also thinking it's, you know, a little 'twas ever thus. I'm always stunned when I think in the early 20th century, the 1920s, you know, Americans thought that Italians and Poles were not smart enough to become Americans. They banned them. You know, the home of the Renaissance. It seems like it's something in our DNA, maybe.
It's true. No, otherizing is unfortunately a part of the American DNA and a part of American history. I should say, as a matter of optimism, that what does seem to help people have a realistic impression of immigrants and have a positive impression of immigrants is actually living with and near immigrants. Among urban residents of the Democratic Party, immigration has never been more popular, according to surveys. And so this is one of the paradoxes of attitudes about immigrants, that what you see both in the U.S. and in Europe is what is sometimes called a halo effect. If you look at cities, cities themselves are positive about immigrants. But in the white suburban areas around cities, that sort of demographic or spatial halo around the downtown metro area, that's where attitudes toward immigrants are most negative. They're close enough to immigrants to feel threatened by them, but not close enough to actually know them.
Well, and the flip side of the positive, do misconceptions about immigrants shape political views?
Oh, absolutely they do. I mean, I don't think you can talk about Trumpism and his rise within the Republican Party without being very explicit about the degree to which his fear-mongering and his otherizing of immigrants played a really important role, not only in his winning the Republican primary, but then in his winning the general election. I think we're living in a time right now in American economics where people are nervous about their wages, about the future for their children. They're looking for someone to blame for their anxiety, for some cause of this anxiety. And it is all too easy, I think, for demagogues and political opportunists to point the finger at immigrants and say, it's their fault, blame them.
Well, it's also a reminder, Derek, that the press has to constantly get out what is true about immigrant populations. Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, thank you, as always, for joining us on Mondays.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now. And then there were six. With the Iowa caucuses 3 weeks away, we take a closer look at the Democratic candidates still in the running for president. Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar, and Tom Steyer hit the debate stage in Des Moines on Tuesday. We'll have a preview. That's next time on Here and Now.